provide a bonanza for Charlie Canfield's Seaside Company and a huge redevelopment bonanza for the friends on this, of the people on the city council. And the idea, kind of a harebrained scheme of somehow increasing the tax revenues and the social services by luring more people into town. Unfortunately, that lure, of course, produces, overworks the traffic, overworks the water, overworks the services, and you have an expanding kind of cancerous kind of growth that destroys the very community that supposedly you're drawing people in to produce revenue for. What's actually happened, again, requires you kind of go into the specifics of what's cooking with the beach area south of Laurel Plan. I'm thumbing through my papers madly. I don't think I have the four pages that I thought I did. What a bummer. Well, but briefly, the big issues, really, I saw them as being two, and of course, a number of them were presented. There was a special city council meeting on Tuesday, which you probably didn't even hear about. I certainly didn't hear about it until earlier in the day. I would have mentioned it at the last Bathrop Spears Broadsides broadcast. That city council meeting was the final kind of shovel of dirt on the tomb of one's hopes around the beach south of Laurel Plan. The beach south of Laurel Plan was, in essence, passed. The environmental impact report was passed, which means that down the road, if these council candidates get one, if the council, current city council, Rotkin, Hernandez, and Matthews, those are the three that are going to remain, Kennedy and Campbell are leaving, but if Rotkin, Hernandez, and Matthews get one vote, Steinau, Walton, or Quartararo are really the only ones they can hope for. If they get one of those people elected, they will have a majority of four, and they will come be able to bring the beach south of Laurel's three big monstrosities right back. That's the Third Street realignment that will bulldoze houses in the beach flats, the redevelopment, the commercial expansion area that will essentially set up a competing retail development, which will again draw business away from the downtown. It's strange that why downtown merchants could even support this. And then the boardwalk expansion, which will give us roller coaster number two, an even bigger one, on the property that the boardwalk has stolen and that the city council has given away to the boardwalk 2 weeks ago, even though Phil Baer showed them and proved to the city attorney's satisfaction that this was city land that the boardwalk has been squatting on, because it was tidelands that the city cannot alienate without a vote by the voters. Well, they're doing it. They're not allowed to give it back directly to the corporation, the Canfield Corporation, so they're going to give it to the state, and the state will give it to the Canfield Corporation. And they're trying to do this without a vote of the voters. And, of course, we're hoping that different folks are going to try to file court suits, and we're also, I'm encouraging people to consider direct protest against this giveaway of public land, which could be used for all kinds of things. It could be used to restore the river. This is river land. This is right right next to the trestle, this tide land. This is what the boardwalk parking lot now sits on. It could be a park. It could be low-income housing. It could be all kinds of things. Instead, it's going to go into the pocket of Charlie Canfield, with the exception of a small acre and a half that the city council is getting back from Canfield instead of the full six or more acres that he really should be giving back to the city. You're tuned to Bathrop Spears Broadsides, and I'm your host, Robert Norse. We are on Free Radio Santa Cruz at 96.3 FM. Your call-in number is 427-3772 if you want to get in touch with me and keep advised as to what's going on. I'm a little bit, as I said, kind of frantically dashing about tonight, trying to get things done. I read a piece for the homeless newspaper Street Sheet in San Francisco. Some of you may have seen it. It's sold by homeless vendors in San Francisco. It's kind of a sister paper to Street Spirit, actually older than Street Spirit, which is a somewhat bigger paper, which I also write for, and their deadline is tonight. I've got a civil rights update to write, so I'm a little frantic. I have to get up to this forum. I feel like I'm going in three or four directions at the same time, and I don't have all my stuff with me. I see I have Michael Hernandez's letter, however, in the Metro Santa Cruz, which has been passed on to me by my producer. I hope she also, if she can find it, I'd like her to, if you're listening, producer, try to find the response. I wrote a response to this letter that Hernandez did. I'll read you Hernandez's letter, and actually I'll wait on reading you that because I'd like to have my response nearby and possibly give you a kind of a preview of what the Metro may or may not print. It's pretty harsh. I've toned it down a bit because I really have a hard time controlling my contempt for Hernandez, who I have a lot of contempt for. He's one of the city council members who kind of waddled into power, essentially a Kennedy protege, Latino ancestry, who has very little in common with low-income Latino people, but who likes to wave them about as a flag and wrap himself in them as though he were somehow their leader or their spokesman or their advocate. I have never heard one person say that she or he regards Hernandez as an advocate for a Latino cause, a Hispanic cause, a cause of people who, because of their skin color, of that particular skin color, are being oppressed in a particular way, which they are. There's no question about it. It's been the case for, since the U.S. conquered the Mexican part of the United States. That's one of those facts of history that you've got masses of oppressed people in this country. And some of them are Latino, some of them are black, some of them are Native American, a lot of them are women. I mean, these aren't just politically correct things to say. These are realities, folks. It's good. It becomes politically correct to admit that reality is reality. But when people begin to dismiss and mock this as simply a form of political correctness, then the situation has kind of deteriorated because people are not recognizing that there are real significant differences in how people are treated and the opportunities they have based on arbitrary factors like race and gender, which is crap, as most of us know. And it's crap that Hernandez jumps on this bandwagon with Kennedy. Looks like Kennedy's writing his speeches. I didn't see Kennedy write his speeches. I have no proof that Kennedy writes his speeches, but I know Kennedy backed his campaign, and Hernandez doesn't seem to have diddly squat to say at city council most of the time. And then suddenly he comes up with this long compromise for the beach south of Laurel Plant, and it's really hard for me to believe that he even understands what he's reading. He is, I don't know, it's hard for me to believe. And the kinds of policies he supports, whether it be curfews for poor people, whether it be more police, in the Resource Center for Nonviolence, whether it be essentially cutting short public process on the beach south of Laurel Plan, he's done all these things. It's really hard to even point to much that he does do, because he does vote on things, so you can say, well, he takes a position here or there by voting, but he you don't really see him that much in terms of actually articulating any clear positions. But he is coming up with this latest smear tactic. He's trashing the Fitzmaurice Crone sugar slate. Now, I did a little trashing myself last week, and I'm not going to let up on them. But I do this in the context of understanding that this slate, Fitzmaurice Crone and Sugar, is about 150% better than Walton Quatrero and Steinau. And I think that's a reality, and I think it even beats saying you should vote for a Democrat over a Republican. Well, it looks like somebody is running here with a letter that I wrote. This is the rough draft of the letter, but that's okay. This looks like the final draft. So I am going to run this by you. This is, again, I guess, pertinent to the politics of the election, which is really right around the corner. Scan is the subject of Michael Hernandez's letter, or so it seems, in this week's Metro. He writes, "The Santa Cruz Action Network has provided us once again with a blank slate by endorsing three white males. Scan has shown us again that diversity doesn't exist on its agenda. When I ran successfully for Santa Cruz City Council in 1996, I assumed that we had crossed a threshold. Despite Scan's rejection of my candidacy, Scan had heard the people and that diversity was important. Here we are 2 years later and SCANA has been true to form. SCANA sent a loud and clear message that does not respect diversity. It will claim it does and has a dozen excuses as to why it doesn't endorse any candidates except white males. SCANA's historical alienation of people of color is well known, but its recent endorsement of the three pale white males leaves even the most skeptical bewildered. In the November election, the Santa Cruz City Council will lose three incumbents, two of whom are women. I am concerned that the election of the slate of white men will create a great gap between the women of this community and the soul of the City Council. Michael Hernandez, Santa Cruz City Councilman. Well, I've been kind of giving you my reaction to Michael Hernandez generally. Now let me read you my letter and response that will probably never see the light of day because the Metro doesn't usually print my stuff, but they sometimes do. But in any case, you're going to hear it now. Dear Metro, Michael Hernandez is back in his Hispanic clown outfit, waving and shouting with a more ethnic-than-thou shtick to distract us from the real issues. What are they? The current City Council majority's contempt for public input and the public interest. It is there that Hernandez has served as dummy for Kennedy's Edgar Bergen for two sad years. The hallmark of the Kennedy-Rotkin majority's insulated arrogance and hypocrisy is its bulldoze the beach flats plan. This beesaw plan is still going forward under cover of Mercy Housing and awaiting the post-election return of the Third Street realignment, the boardwalk expansion, and expanded commercial retail development. The council has already given away the riverfront, Hernandez voting aye. The crucial beach flats environmental impact report is in place, and any public process for Third Street has been assigned to the beach committee. Who will probably head that committee, which canceled meeting after meeting in the past and failed to take any input from beach flats residents? None other than the strong, silent Hernandez. If voters heed Hernandez's self-serving race and gender baiting nonsense. Rotkin will get the one new non-progressive council member he needs. Canfield will get his million-dollar redevelopment. Hernandez's beach flats barrio brothers and sisters will get evicted, and the voters will get screwed. Again, Hernandez wails about pale males and whites, but it is the same pale male Rotkin-Kennedy majority on city council that is using Hernandez's brown skin color and his implied but bogus Latino seal of approval to discredit insurgent progressives who are far more responsive to the rights of women, minorities, and the community generally. Hernandez's latest yapping and snapping at SCANA is election eve button pushing to conceal the real issues and defeat the Crone, Sugar, Fitzmaurice progressive slate. SCANA finally woke up years too late, in my view, and decided that Rotkin and Kennedy had gone one gateway too far. How to counter progressive outrage at their betrayal? Send in Hernandez, the man who has trouble stringing sentences together at City Council, the invisible council member whose voice is rarely heard and vote is almost always in Kennedy's pocket. When did we last hear of Hernandez? His name hits the papers when he vandalized posters at the Harley-Davidson dealership and used his office and political connections to pass the buck and avoid charges. Hernandez, the great defender of women, the man who wagged his tail as Kennedy connived to steal the mayorship from Celia Scott, probably the best council member in two decades. Had this scheme been successful, the map, air quality, coffers, water availability, and compassion quotient of Santa Cruz would be significantly different. As it is, Rotkin's redevelopment renegades have trashed the homeless garden at Pelton Street, criminalized the poor for sleeping, and given away the waterfront. Kennedy has now aimed Hernandez at Crone, Fitzmaurice, and Sugar. Did Hernandez even write the Metro letter? It sounds like his master's voice. The bitter smell of a progressive gone bad is unmistakable. Is that a smell we're going to have to endure every 2 weeks until November 2000? Maybe so, if Hernandez's last-minute race card routine brings in one of the Kennedy-favored redevelopers on the Steinau-Quattararo-Walton ticket. And that's my somewhat too long letter to the Metro Santa Cruz, which I'm going to send back in response to Hernandez's letter today. Well, a lot of talking with me, and the time is ticking away here. Last time, we did some reviewing of positions by the candidates at the Downtown Association. This is, of course, really was a very small forum. There were less than a dozen people in the audience most of the time. But it was a forum, of course, that candidates presumably felt they had to cater to the merchants downtown. And cater they did. We heard from a number of them last show. I think we heard from Sugar, and we heard a bit from Crone. We heard from Walton, trashing the homeless in different degrees. It wasn't. I'm not going to say that Crone went out of his way or Sugar went out of his way to trash the homeless, but they seemed to back away from the positions they had held, that you should simply begin by saying, it's time to stop arresting people for sleeping. I will make one of my priorities on city council to pass that law once I get into power, provided I have the votes, or even if I don't. This position seemed to be, as I said, getting softer and softer, even among the progressives. And of course, among Quartararo, Walton, and Steinau, the bad guys, as far as I'm concerned, in this election, not bad as human beings, but certainly bad in terms of their political positions, it was far worse. Let's hear some more from this Downtown Association forum on the issues of homelessness in the downtown. I think that that's really something important to be aware of when we go into the ballot on November 3rd. Or even if we don't. If you don't believe in voting, it's something you should know about anyway, because these are big figures in the community, and they, if they're talking wrong, they need to be trashed, at least in terms of what they're saying. They need to be challenged, they need to be countered. So here's a bit more of the Downtown Association and positions on the sleeping ban and the other elements to downtown, like the drug war. You're listening here to Chris Crone, and I apologize for the sound quality, but bear with us.
A lot of folks there felt like they didn't have a voice with respect to the city council and the things changing in the neighborhood. It took a lot of organizing coming together, and some things have changed. But as I said earlier, I just want to reemphasize, because I think it's one of the most important things in this election, is giving neighborhoods a voice on the council and having them feel like they're heard, and not only having to come to council meetings, because that's uncomfortable for a lot of people, but as a council member, I will make a bill myself to going out into the neighborhoods and meeting the neighbors on whatever issues they want. I remember using phone book and people were ready to get in City Hall. So giving neighbors a voice, that's one of my neighborhood top three priorities. I don't have a one, two, or three. There's many issues facing the city right now. I think dealing with the housing issue right now, creating more affordable housing, opening up a dialogue between the university and the city much wider than has been opened thus far, creating some, looking into the notion of infill projects around the downtown area as far as we're going to live, and that I think would alleviate transportation problems.
One of the things that happened, I mean, like I said, I was I thought it was devastating when it all fell down. And I thought it was moving too slowly when it was being rebuilt. And it was frustrating to me. And I love the downtown. Now I think there are specific things that need to happen downtown to make this a much, functional environment, keep it a functional environment. One thing that I just to point out is that the city council has to be really sensitive to people having any glass and people that are being impacted right now by the rebuilding of Cooper House. Somehow we have to figure out how people are going to have access to businesses. And I've seen the same thing happening, and people talk more about traffic scheduling happened on the River Street project, the same thing is happening on the Mission Street project, but somehow the city council, in connection with whatever agencies are doing this kind of work, have to be assertive about making sure that the customer base will still support those businesses while these projects are underway. In fact, I suggested that we send out postcards to all the businesses on Mission Street that they could send out that says basically, terrible things are happening, but it's not the business's fault. Please come to these businesses because the community needs to be supported in this way. There are various other things, including a shuttle system on Mission, and things that I think could help to make that project at least a bit more tolerable, less devastating. And I think to see the devastation that can happen in these small areas. And I think the city council, my plans are pretty much, I would like to direct our attention toward those exact kinds of things. Make sure that we can, as a city, support the person who's having the immediate difficulty in that regard. Larger plans are important, larger visions are important, but to some extent we have to stay within ourselves. Often will be a huge issue, it's a huge issue in my neighborhood. And I can, I think I'm very much supportive of alternative transportation. I'm looking at the short term, and like railroad, all those things are done at the long term, but in the short term, we need to be extremely assertive, and we need to provide some leadership so that people can start to use various alternatives, so that the people who work downtown, for instance, might be more served by alternatives, free parking, an alternative, and a remote lot, that kind of thing. Who knows what we can do or propose that would help people, because the people that I know that work downtown, they're my friends, and who park near my house sometimes, because it's still not public parking, in some respect, they're very clear with me about what it would cost for them to do otherwise. And so we need some way to provide that kind of support, and I think I'm very supportive of alternative transportation. So downtown's my favorite point. So I'm hoping that what we can do is to invest some energy into making sure that the small things don't create imbalances that would be devastating to individuals.
I think that, again, outreach is critical. I think that it is the city's responsibility, both for the kids that are using drugs, as well as for the merchants that may be affected by drug use and the criminal activity that goes along with the use of drugs. And again, I'm interested in how do you deal with the problem at its roots. Police enforcement of these laws I support. I support a strong police presence wherever this becomes a problem. But more importantly, what I support is going to the root core of the problem.
And this is Keith Sugar, apparently championing police enforcement against the drug war, which I found very nauseating. But it sounded like most of the other candidates. Nobody said anything about the drug war being the problem and not the solution. Nobody talked about the expanded police budget and this huge new police station and all this millions are going into that without any really effective police review at all as being really part of the problem in Santa Cruz. So because we haven't created that dialogue, we have the problem of candidates who are being kind of drawn to the right. Again, listen to more of Keith Sugar at the Downtown Association Forum.
Things that cause our kids to use drugs. I support Above the Line. I support the Drop-In Center. I support the M1 Street Complex. I support funding these programs that are geared at getting the kids the help they need. As we heard earlier about the young man that died of an overdose, he didn't want that lifestyle. But addiction is a bona fide condition. It is something that is not willing, it is not something that is volitional. The way you get kids off the drugs is you deal with the root core problem. That's good for business, and that's good for the kids. I think that's what we need to do, and we can fund those programs. We need to fund those programs. We need to fund those programs because that's also what's good for business downtown. We can move money around. We can move money around from redevelopment, and instead of funding the realignment of Third Street, perhaps now we can use some of those funds to make more adequate the funding of the M.Y. Street complex above the line, the drop-in center, et cetera. So I believe that if we're creative, we can get the funding, and I believe that if we are resolute, we can reach every kid that comes down the pike and get them off the street.
And that was Keith Sugar at the Downtown Association. Very stirring words, but they sounded a little too glitzy political for me. And what about the kids you can't reach and that are on the street? It's okay to strong-arm these folks and give them curbside justice and you let police do what they want, the kind of photograph them for and search them for no good reason stuff that's going on and been going on for a year downtown. Gang association list them. All the practices that are standard SCPD practice downtown, all in the interest of the drug war. I don't hear any concerns from Keith Sugar, the environmental lawyer, on this. I wish I did, and maybe I will, and I hope people bring this issue to his attention. Again, I want to remind you the number to call for these three candidates, the one you were just listening to, Keith Sugar, is 462-2053, Tim Fitzmaurice, 423-1167, 423-1167, and Chris Crone, 423-1066. That was a rather badly recorded first person who spoke, 423-1066. Again, Sugar's number is 462-2053. Call him up and set these folks straight. I think there may be some chance to educate him before terminal arrogance sets in.
From rounds 4 and 5.
And this is Canfield's banker, Rod Quattararo. I call him Canfield's banker not because he's Canfield's personal banker, but because he works at the bank that Canfield has a lot of money at and owns part of and does most of his business with. And he also, Rod Quattararo, sits on the planning commission that voted on the beach boardwalk giveaway, and he didn't disqualify himself, which I found to be a notorious conflict of interest. He's talking here about the camping ban. He's been asked about whether he supports it. Notice, again, the question is posed not as the sleeping ban, which is a part of the camping ban that we've been trying to eliminate, but as the entire camping ban. So the broadness of the question is, it's still a meaningful question in some sense, but it doesn't really cover the main issue of the campaign for the last year that we've been putting forward, which is the right for people to sleep, not to camp, not to set up a tent, though in fact they should be allowed to do that as well, but to sleep. That's what we're talking about right now, a human right to sleep. And this is what that the merchant candidate, Rod Quattararo, who with Linda Steinau is again getting the major bucks from the Chamber of Commerce, has gotten the Sentinel endorsement. This is what he says.
Yes, it's currently written. I take a little bit of a different read on some of these things. I also spoke, during a campaign, you speak to everybody, it seems like, and I spoke to one of the directors dealing with the homeless situation here in town, and their statement was that they are having one heck of a time right now trying to balance the budget right now and dealing with the very needy homeless people out there right now. Her statement was that the city needs to increase its funding so she can concentrate a little more on dealing with the problems.
And the man that Quattararo is probably talking about, based upon the comments he's already made, I should say the woman that Quattararo is probably talking about, is none other than the woman I mentioned at the beginning of the show, Homeless Community Resource Director Karen Gillette, whom many activists regard as something of a traitor, who stepped in and seized homeless services that should have gone to homeless activists who were really advocating for the homeless and were interested in pushing the struggle further. They wanted, of course, to push the struggle out of town and to divide it, that is to say, the downtown politicians, the downtown merchants, and a number of the nonprofits, and so they chose Karen Gillette to do the dirty work for them. He is now, of course, Cordoraro is no friend of homeless people. He is using her as his source to attack changes and to attack basic human rights for the homeless. He's using Karen Gillette as the basis for saying they shouldn't be allowed to sleep at night. Let's hear more.
She also encourages the business community. She appreciates the job that the business community has done in contributing to the shelter program, but is also asking council members and so forth to do a little bit more budget-wise. It's much easier to deal in a positive way when you're dealing with a budget in the black rather than always looking over your shoulder at things dealing in the red. With this person's comment that she likened a little bit lifting of the camping van to the situation that they found down behind the River Street shelter when the camping of sorts was allowed down there for a particular number of families. And it was almost as though the Pandora's box opened. It went from 200 manageable people down there, and she said at the peak of things there were close to 800 people down there.
Now this is the most preposterous bullshit that I've ever heard. I'm sorry to be so outspoken, and perhaps I'm not sorry. No one has ever claimed, other than, I don't know who, that there have ever been more than 300 people in the Coral Street open air shelter. And that was, of course, badly overcrowded. But it was an improvement on conditions elsewhere. People were given a legal place to be, so they came there and they used that area as best they could, and they tried to form their own community, and they were in essence bulldozed away from it, allegedly for the pretext of the community house project, but actually because Rotkin, Kennedy, and Daryl Darling wanted to remove them. And nothing in that area sat fenced off and locked away for a year and a half. No one was allowed to sleep on it but the favorites of Karen Gillette and the favorites of the Citizens Committee for the Homeless. Those weren't many. Those were the paid employees. It was really kind of a disgraceful situation. And here we see history turned on its head by Rod Quattoraro, who, using Karen Gillette as his source, describes it as some sort of horrible travesty, that something bad and horrible in a Pandora's box was happening, when in fact it was a place where people could sleep, could store their stuff, could go out from work and do work during the day, return and find their pets still there at night. It had lots of problems. It was miserably treated by the Citizens Committee for the Homeless, which didn't provide it with adequate trash pickups or adequate porta-potties, and Karen Gillette refused that campground its bathrooms at night and the facilities at night. Why did she do that? Well, she told me, because I have a couple of workers who sleep in the bays there, and they'd be upset to have people coming in. I guess you can judge the quality of her work from the quality of that kind of reasoning. That shows you exactly where her head's at on that, in that matter. Anyway, again, the key here is that Quattoraro, and you'll also hear Steinau, in essence are quoting or misquoting to some extent, because I don't even think Karen Gillette believes that 800 people were at the campground. If so, she's got more problems than I thought. I must say she is quoted in the Mid-County Post as saying there were 600 people at the campground, and that, of course, again, is sheer fantasy. We counted most 297 people when it was really at its height, when we were organizing there, and it was, you know, really filled up, and people were, you know, it was winter time. People didn't want to use the armory because the armory was too restricted, because the armory didn't let couples in, because the armory didn't let pets in, because the armory required standing in line for hours. Because the armory was a place where you could get sick a lot more easily, because the armory was a place where you had no privacy. All these conditions are going to reoccur in about a month when the armory reopens at a bigger cost to the city because they refused to open up a campground. And these are all, of course, now being demonized by Karen Gillette, Rod Quattoraro, Linda Steinau. And it also has to be said by the three progressive candidates. You can't find the courage by any of these progressive candidates to stand up and talk about what really happened. We do, however, have an interview with someone who will talk about what really happened. That's going to happen later in the show. I'm going to be on my way up to UCSC. We're going to talk to Dan Hopkins, who lived out there at the campground, who organized people around the organization Save Our Shelter, and who really saw what was going on. He doesn't talk a lot about it, but he does mention it. Let's continue now with the Downtown Association Forum. with Rod Quartararo answering the question about saying that he does support the camping ban, as he puts it, as it is. That is to say, what he really means, of course, is he supports arresting people for sleeping at night because merchants don't want unsightly bodies anywhere in the vicinity to interfere with their tourist dollars.
Word got around that the doors were open here once again, and pandering and prostitution and drug use ran rampant down there. I fear that by not doing things in an orderly way, by lifting the camping ban as it was once before, that we might be encouraging this sort of situation to again, once again, reoccur throughout our town. We might be encouraging the immigration of homeless people from out of our area, homeless people who are homeless by their own choice rather than victims of circumstances.
So we hear the Rotkin-type spectacle of people homeless by choice, the magnet theory, the evil Coral Street open-air shelter, a disorderly situation, all these kind of fear-ridden images being raised by the conservative candidate. And would that we had a champion who would challenge these misconceptions and set people straight, talk some real sense to people instead of dealing with these boogeymen. But alas, we don't have that at the moment. If you want that to happen, on the other hand, I suggest you call the three candidates who are most likely to be able to wring reality out of these boogeyman images: Keith Sugar at 462-2053, Tim Fitzmaurice at 423-1167, and Chris Crone at 423-1066. If you miss any of these numbers, you can give a call to 423-HUFF, and I'll get them to you after the show. And if you want to comment on anything you're hearing, 427-3772 is the number to call.
And actually, I've got to excuse myself.
I guess an official question for you on your position on the traffic.
One of the houses is very important to me. I've got two sons, 17 and 20.
Those were a series of cuts, but we're now hearing Linda Steinau, who is the Downtown Association Duchess and really the most dangerous candidate of the group in terms of her likelihood to win and break the progressive slate, talking about so-called affordable housing.
Yeah, and I was fortunate enough to buy a house here 25 years ago, so it's the only reason I'm able to be in that market. I would like to do everything possible to continue the affordable housing programs that we have in place. We have some very successful ones. The Sycamore housing project right at the end of Pacific Avenue has turned out very well. A lot of people have moved from Ridge Flats into that area, and they're delighted. It's safe, and it's clean, and kids have playgrounds. The Murray housing area is another one that's been very successful. I think there's an old concept of urban renewal from the 60s, and those were not really successful models. I think that we here in Santa Cruz have developed some very successful models for affordable housing. So that, to me, is a very primary concern. As we know, we live in a very desirable area. The rents and housing costs are very high. So I would like to do everything to create public-private partnerships, which all of these projects that I named have been, and continue that. The other ones, of course, transportation alternatives, water supply. We all know that those are very real things. Neighborhood protection is very important to me, too. I feel that many of the measures that are currently in place to protect neighborhoods, I would continue to bolster those. We have the traffic calming measures, we've got the speed humps, we've got one-way streets, street closures, parking programs, all of those that will continue to increase so that we can keep the residential neighborhoods intact, keep the traffic out of them as much as possible, and make everybody's quality of life as best as it can be in the neighborhoods. So those, other than what everybody else has mentioned, are very important.
Thank you.
The absolutely most exciting thing that is happening downtown is the head boxes being built at the corner of South Hill.
And this, of course, is Whoops-a-Daisy Walton, who is praising as the absolutely most exciting thing downtown are the penthouses being built downtown. Here's a Leona Helmsley that isn't afraid to say so. I mean, you know, I like Jane as a person. In fact, I don't have anything against any of them as people. But it's incredible that she would take such a public position, penthouses over people. I mean, it's amazing. Let's hear more of Jane Walton's response.
This is true urban living. The most of the living units in the downtown area prior to this time are either intentionally low income or lower income kinds of units, and to have actual market rate penthouse type apartments on Pacific Avenue means that we had turned the corner in an attitude. I find that extremely exciting. Years and years and years and years ago, prior to the earthquake, of course, the Palace Arts building was for sale, I believe, the old one. And I went into the city planning department, and I said, wow, could this building be converted to living units?
And that was about as much as I could take at the Downtown Association Forum. I wasn't there. It was really graciously recorded for me and has been videotaped by Becky Johnson, who may use it for, a Halloween horror show. I'm not sure what she's got in mind for that particular one, but I've given you some of the horrible highlights of that particular forum. Again, a lot of election eve gobbledygook, blather about affordable housing, no key positions on stopping police abuse or any real meaningful alternatives downtown. Again, as I said, I don't think that means that three of the candidates cannot be, should we say, changed or educated. I'm probably wrong, of course. I'd like to get optimistic because I know the three of them can't be educated, so that is for sure. So I guess I hate to recommend that people run off and vote for example, bad Democrats like Gray Davis over worse Republicans like Dan Lundgren, and I don't think I will. But at the local city council level, where I actually know the people involved, Chris Crone, Keith Sugar, Tim Fitzmaurice, I will continue to go out on a limb and suggest you vote for them. Let's get the rails and the tar ready to run them out of town if they don't do anything. And I don't think, I'm worried that they're not going to, but we know that the other three won't. So, I don't know. Let's take a little comic break here. Here's something I've been waiting to play for about 3 months. This is one of my favorite routines from the 40s. It's Abbott and Costello, you may remember those two, doing the famous full-fledged Who's On First routine. So let's hear Who's On First. And then we'll figure out who's on first when we go up to the candidates forum at 8 o'clock up at Kresge College, where I hope to join all my listeners up there.
Well, Costello, I'm going to New York with you. You know, Bucky Harris, the Yanks manager, gave me a job as coach for as long as you're on the team.
Look, Abbott, if you're a coach, you must know all the players.
I certainly do.
Well, you know, I never met the guys, so you'll have to tell me their names, and then I'll know who's playing on the team.
Oh, I'll tell you their names, but you know, strange as it may seem, they give these ball players nowadays very peculiar names.
Funny names?
Strange names, pet names, like Dizzy Dean and...
His brother Daffy.
Daffy Dean.
And their French cousin.
French?
Gouffet.
Gouffet Dean, oh, I see. Well, let's see, we have on the bags, we have who's on first, what's on second, I don't know who's on third.
That's what I want to find out.
I say, who's on first, what's on second, I don't know who's on third.
Are you the manager?
Yes.
You're going to be the coach too?
Yes.
And you know the fellow's name?
Oh, I should.
Well, then who's on first?
Yes.
I mean the fellow's name.
Who?
The guy on first.
Who?
The first base.
Who?
The guy playing
who
first.
Who is on first?
I'm asking you who's on first.
That's the man's name.
That's whose name?
Yes.
Well, go ahead and tell
that's
me.
That's it.
That's who?
Yes.
You got a first baseman?
Certainly.
Who's playing first?
That's right.
When you pay off the first baseman every month, who gets the money?
Every dollar of it.
All I'm trying to find out is the fellow's name on first base.
Who?
The guy that gets the
that's
money.
That's it.
Who gets the money on
he
first
base? He does, every dollar. Sometimes his wife comes down and collects it.
Whose wife?
Yes.
Look, all I want to know is when you sign up the first baseman, How does he sign his name to the contract? The guy.
Who?
How does he sign his
name? That's how he signs it.
Who?
Yes.
What's the guy's name on first base?
No, what is on second base?
I'm not asking you who's on second.
Who's on first?
One base at a time.
Well, don't change the players.
I'm not changing nobody.
Take it easy, buddy.
I'm only asking you, who's the guy on first base?
That's right.
Okay.
All right.
What's the guy's name on first base?
No, what is on second?
I'm not asking you who's on second.
Who's on first?
I don't know.
Oh, he's on third. We're not talking about him.
How did I get on third base?
Why, you mentioned his name.
If I mention a third baseman's name, who did I say is playing third?
No, who's playing first?
What's on first?
What's on second?
I don't know.
He's on first.
There I go, back on third
again.
Now, who's playing third base?
Why do you insist on putting who on third base?
What am I putting on third?
What is on second?
You don't want who on second.
Who is on first?
I don't know. Third base! You got outfield?
Sure.
Not a fielder's name.
Why?
I just thought I'd ask.
Well, I just thought I'd tell you.
Now, tell me who's playing left field.
Who is playing first?
I'm not staying out of the infield. I want to know what's the guy's name in left field.
No, what is on second?
I'm not asking you who's on
who's
second.
Who's on first?
I don't know. Third base! And the left field was named?
Why?
Because.
Oh, he's center field.
He is field. Look, you got a pitcher on the team.
Sure.
What's the pitcher's name?
Tomorrow.
You don't want to tell me today?
I'm telling you,
then
man.
Go ahead.
Tomorrow.
What time?
What time what?
What time tomorrow are you going to tell me who's pitching?
Now listen, who is not pitching?
I'll break your arm, you say, who's on first. I want to know what's the pitcher's name.
What's on second?
I don't know.
Third base.
Got a catcher?
Certainly.
The catcher's name.
Today.
Today. And tomorrow's pitcher.
Now you've got it.
All we got is a couple of days on the team. I'm a catcher too.
No, they don't.
I get behind the plate, do some fancy catching. Tomorrow's pitching on my team, and a heavy hitter gets up.
Yes.
Now the heavy hitter bunts the ball. When he bunts the ball, me being a good catcher, I'm gonna throw the guy out of first base. So I pick up the ball and throw it to who?
Now that's the first thing you've said right.
I don't even know what I'm talking about.
All you have to do
is to throw the ball to first base.
Yes.
Now who's got it?
Naturally.
Somebody's got to get it. Now, who has it?
Naturally.
Who?
Naturally.
Naturally?
Naturally.
So I pick up the ball and I throw it to naturally.
No, you don't. You throw the ball to who?
Naturally.
That's different.
That's what I say.
You're not saying
I throw the ball to naturally.
You throw it to who?
Naturally.
That's it.
That's what I said.
Listen, you ask me.
I throw the ball to who?
Naturally.
Now, you ask me.
You throw the ball to who?
Naturally.
That's